Welcome, everyone, to the 20th and final live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. My name is Christy Peoples. I'm a producer here at Sounds True, and I'll be your host. Today, Dr. John Arden will be teaching on mind-brain-gene, the integration of psychotherapy. He's broadcasting live, while the Sounds True team and I are here, also live, in our Boulder studios. A free recording of this session will remain accessible for 24 hours. If you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, transcripts from each session, and bonus gifts from our presenters. And now, it's my honor to introduce you to John Arden. John Arden, Ph.D., is the author of 14 books, including his most recent, Brain to Brain, as well as The Brain Bible, Rewire Your Brain, Brain-Based Therapy with Adults, and Brain-Based Therapy with Children and Adolescents. He is currently the Chief Academic Officer for the Institute of Behavioral Health, a division of the Institute of Brain Potential. He has presented workshops on brain-based therapy in over 25 countries and in all U.S. states. Welcome, John.
Well, thank you so much, Christy. It's a pleasure to be here. I want to let the listeners know that I'm actually at a conference on behavioral medicine. And earlier today, I presented a variant of this presentation. The focus that I want to touch on today with all of you is the interaction between the mind, the brain, and the immune system. And to start this discussion, I think that everybody ought to know the ACE study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, because it tells us so much about how early experience can have ripple effects throughout our lives, affecting our immune system, affecting the structure of the brain, affecting our ability to control our affect, and our overall sense of well-being. So what is the ACE study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study? Well, it was performed in the organization I used to work for. So for the prior 26 years, I worked for Kaiser Permanente in Northern California, where I ran the training programs, and about 750 miles south, where I'm now located here in San Diego at this conference, Vince Folletti, who was a primary care physician at Kaiser Permanente, and his colleagues at Center for Disease Control took a look at over 17,000 patients. And what they were trying to do was to take a look at the effect of early experience, how it affects various adverse outcomes. So what are these adverse childhood experiences? Well, they could be living in a family with domestic violence. They could be divorce in the family, crime, mental illness, substance abuse, being abused yourself. And each one of these categories then were counted and then correlated with various health outcomes. So let's take a look at some of them to begin with. We want to get a sense of what types of adverse childhood experiences. There are categories that relate to psychological or physical abuse, sexual abuse, loss of a parent. And we also want to make note that over half the 17,000 patients, over half, 52%, had more than one adverse childhood experience. So only 48 had no adverse childhood experiences that I'll just continue to refer to as ACEs. So as you can see in this one image, about 25% of people had at least one ACE. And of course, those people that were really impounded had seven, either three or four adverse childhood experience ACE. So now, Vince and his colleagues in the Kaiser Permanente system were looking initially in the 1980s at obesity. Who are the folks that are coming in for this bypass surgery? What are some of the life experiences they had prior to? And they were really astounded by the number of not so good things happening in their childhood. And then by the end of the 1990s, they decided to do this wide net study. And they found that with severe obesity, as the ACEs count up, your vulnerability, your tendency to become obese also goes up. And your lifestyle, some of the things that you do, like not read the package of the cigarettes where it says since 1965, smoking can cause lung disease. You'll do it anyway. Or no, I'm not going to get it. I've seen other people, you know, it's not going to happen to me. Or I'm going to do it anyway. So you start to adopt lifestyle practices that impair your health. How about coronary heart disease? Well, this partly relates to the impact of stress overall. And so if you can see how after five or six ACEs, seven or eight just shoots through the roof. And people with that many ACEs really wear down their plumbing system in their body and their brain. They might then start doing such things as drinking alcohol. So the ACE score, you see a stepwise increase with alcoholism and with various types of drug abuse. And how about hallucinations that may or may not be associated with substances? So you see a stepwise increase there as well. How about the experience of unexplained symptoms associated with sexual abuse early on? So many people in primary care departments are constantly seeing folks with aches or pains or physical complaints that there's no clear etiology or no clear disease process or injury or whatever. Just maybe dysphoric feelings that are turned into aches and pains. How about teenage sexual behaviors seem to go up? Early sexual acting out, age 13 and so on, teen pregnancy and teen paternity also go up. By the way, what I'm trying to do here is set the stage for the discussion about the mind, the brain, the immune system. And so what I'm trying to do is show you the wide range of different effects from these early experiences. So let's take a look at the kinds of social factors that a person might experience. You had a number of ACEs, let's say, and maybe now you've got over 50 sexual partners. Now, these are folks that are, I mean, if you think about 50, over 50 sexual partners, you may not even know them very well over a period of time. How about being sexually abused as male children impregnating a teenage girl? Or now, because you have many sex partners, you don't know who these people are, you might be practicing unsafe sex, you're going to be more susceptible to various sexually transmitted diseases, or later being raped. Maybe in date rape kind of situations, maybe hanging around people that are really, really dangerous people that might then put you in a very, very precarious position. We also see various types of productive behaviors get, let's say, dysregulated, like impaired worker performance, or maybe you are in a family environment later on in life as an adult with domestic violence. For much of the 1980s, I was on the board of directors of a domestic violence series of programs up in Napa County. And we saw many folks who had ACEs, both men and women, prior to the whole cycle of violence. How about being an abuser? People in these anger management programs that might have been also abused or saw their father be abused. Well, this has been part of our mental health culture for some time, being present during this modeling behavior. Well, all of this contributes to very troubling feeling, very icky feeling, very traumatic overreactions, hypervigilance, and what we see is an increase in the prevalence of suicide. So just take a look at the difference between one ACE and four ACEs with regard to attempted suicide. And as a prelude to what I'll talk about a little later, the level of inflammation, in other words, the mind-brain immune system is interrelated. And what we find with experiencing trauma early on is inflammation levels go up. So there's a very strong correlation with high levels of, not high levels, but chronic inflammation with suicide acting out. A lifetime history of depression goes up, stepwise increase. And as you see here, there is a difference between men and women. Women outnumber men 2-to-1 for depression. There are multiple reasons that is the case. And one of them is diagnostic, of course, and that men, when they are depressed, don't look as clearly depressed. They might look like they have anger problems or they might have difficulty expressing their feelings about their feelings, expressing their thoughts about their feelings, rather. And what we also see is an overall increase of antidepressant medication. Now, this is a little different for some countries. The United States, I strongly feel, overuses medications, and the efficacy isn't as strong as we had hoped in the past, but nevertheless, you see a stepwise increase of the use of antidepressant medications. And now you're hanging around people doing not so smart things, multiple sex partners, practicing unsafe sex, even shooting drugs and sharing needles. So now you're a greater risk of HIV. Back when I was a community mental health administrator back in the 1980s, one of my programs had a homeless outreach, and certainly we found that a lot of the homeless that we were dealing with, at least, had a number of ACEs early on. And in American cities nowadays, what we see is a lot of folks out there who unfortunately are almost like the untouchables in India, whereby we're not paying as much attention to them and trying to provide them services. But many of these people are seriously troubled folks, in addition to all the socioeconomic factors. So if you have more than four ACEs, four or more ACEs compared to somebody with no ACEs, you will live 20 fewer years than someone with no ACEs. Now, your death process is not going to be nice and clean. You're going to be stumbling around the healthcare system, interacting with various counselors and social workers, psychologists, and other kinds of healthcare workers, having trouble through school and all that. And as a consequence of all this, you're adopting health risk behaviors and it's not going to be a clean drop-off. So what we need to do is understand this larger picture of how these early experiences have ramifications throughout our overall life. So let's take a look at how we're reconceptualizing the mental health field and trying to understand how these ACEs have this ripple effect. If you consider what two of our founding grandparents said roughly 100 years ago, William James and Sigmund Freud. They hypothesized that we would someday in the future be talking about how psychotherapy affects the brain. Well, they didn't know much about the brain back 100 years. years ago. They didn't know much about the prefrontal cortex. We're going to be talking about that a little later. But now you go this 100 years later, and now we're talking about epigenetics. So Eric Kandel, who won the Nobel Prize back in the year 2000, said that psychotherapy works by producing changes in gene expression that alter the strength of synaptic connections. So no longer are we talking about genes or destiny. Back in the 1980s, people were kind of thinking about genetic astrology. This is my genetic, destiny here, and that's all there is to it. There's nothing I can do about it. Well, now we're talking about turning on and off genes based on our lifestyles. And some of these behavioral aspects are things that are done to us or not done to us, like child abuse or neglect. And so if you consider the epigenetic spectrum, what you're seeing here is either a methylation process or acetylation process. So acetylation actually allows these histone bodies to unwrap and be expressed, or methylation kind of keeps them in place, so to speak. So you may want to not have gene expression in areas that you might be a little bit more vulnerable around some disease processes, or on the other hand, you want to have some gene expression that are the result of positive early experiences. So what we find through a lot of very fascinating research over the last 20 years, including Michael Meany's work at McGill University and others, initially with rats and later with humans, is early positive experience results in decrease stress later on. In other words, you have a better thermostat later on. So Meany and others were working with rats, mothers and rat pups. And good mother licking rats, meaning good nurturance, produced their offspring with better cortisol receptor genes that line up or on the hippocampus that act like a thermostat. So if you can imagine a thermostat on the wall, as the heat goes up, the thermostat turns off the heat because, that heat's gone up. So imagine the thermostat function in your brain and your hippocampus and hypothalamus, whereby when cortisol goes up, you can turn down the cortisol. That's good affect regulation. So what we find is that the psychodynamic theorists like Bowlby and Winnicott and others were right all along. Without understanding epigenetics, they knew that early positive care resulted in a better thermostat, a better affect regulatory capacity later on in life. And that not only involves the cortisol receptor gene and so on, but also more serotonin, that's the 5-HT on your slide there, lower levels of cortical releasing hormone, and so on. So what we want to do is help people earn security. So a lot of people that have ACEs maybe be insecurely attached. That doesn't necessarily mean that they can never be positively attached later on, but we want to help them develop this thermostat function, because in contrast to a good thermostat function, there's a hair trigger. A hypervigilance that can occur if you are neglected or you have poor parenting early on. And we actually see some of this research be correlated with preemies. So if you think about a preemie that's born a whole month earlier or something, and they're kept in an incubator, and they're not held, they're not cuddled and sung to bed and have all this wonderful warmth that they're absorbing through the bonding experience. Well, preemies seem to have some not so good epigenetic effects, less of a thermostat function. That doesn't mean they're done for. We can certainly help them earn security, so to speak. And what we also see is that people with ACEs have other types of chromosomal damage. So think in terms of the telomere research. The telomeres are the caps on the ends of your chromosomes. If you're wearing shoes right now, you have tassels on the ends of your shoelaces. Those tassels protect the shoelaces from fraying. So the telomeres are similar to those tassels in that they cap the ends of your chromosomes and protect them. And every time the cells divide, telomeres shrink. It's a biomarker for aging. And so we can speed up the aging process or slow it down. And a lot of it has to do with the enzyme that comes and protects the telomeres. And the protection of the telomeres include the maximization of insulin growth factor, vascular endothelial growth factor, that's the VEGF, and so on. All of these, by the way, are increased by aerobic exercise. So aerobic exercise is one of the seeds factors that I'll touch on a little later that's so critical that we get on a daily basis for our overall health, our mental health, including the protection of our telomeres. Unfortunately, now we are experiencing a pandemic. We lead the world in obesity. So remember, I was saying that Vince started out his research by taking a look at obesity. And we didn't know we were going to lead the world in it. But since 1980, we have been experiencing this explosive problem, and certainly with childhood obesity in a dramatic way, because instead of kids going out playing in the neighborhood, they're sitting in front of their computers and they're stuffing themselves with whatever. And much of what they're stuffing themselves with is not very nutritious. So if you look at the obesity epidemic, it's not necessarily uniform across the United States. There are epicenters, and the Deep South seems to be the epicenter, Louisiana, Mississippi especially. I was giving a talk down in both states last summer, and in fact, I was talking a lot about the effects of obesity, because it's not about vanity that we're talking about. We're talking about the effect on one's brain. So let's focus a little bit on what happens here. Let's say you have ACEs, and you know, you have a hard time calming yourself down, and you think in terms of, you know, can't wait to get home so I can get some of that comfort food, and that always helps me feel more at ease and everything. So take a look at this panel. On the right, you see two brains. And one's the so-called control person, that's a person that's not obese, and the one on the left of the right panel is an obese subject. And compare them to the two brains on the left. Here you have a cocaine addict on the right side of the left panel, and a non-cocaine addict. Well, the so-called normal of both panels, which are on the left of both panels, what you see is more activity in this basal ganglia area, the area of the brain that has the nucleus accumbens. The nucleus accumbens is one of the pleasure centers of the brain. And the greater amount of activity that you have there, and specifically it relates to the number of medium spiny neurons that you have in that area, the greater repertoire of positive experiences that you can have, and that you don't narrow your attention to one specific area. So with regard to the coke addict has turned his brain into limiting his pleasure to just when he is using coke. You can see this with alcoholism too, and you can also see this with being addicted to comfort food. And so what we want to be doing, of course, is expanding the versatility, the repertoire of positive experiences that we have. And that should be part of our work with people with various addictions, including gambling. The gambling brain looks somewhat like the right side of each one of these panels. Well, if you do eat too much, then you're going to develop all sorts of health problems like metabolic syndrome that's now part of this pandemic. Perhaps as many as half the population of the United States. And what you we also see is where you store your fat cells has a major effect on your brain function. So also in the Kaiser Permanente system, we did this big study, specifically our division of research, Rachel Rittner and others, did a study on where your fat cells are. So if you got fat cells in the middle of your abdomen as opposed to your butt or your legs, that's worse than getting the fat down. So if you have extra fat cells, get it down, get it down. But better yet, don't have extra fat cells, because what fat cells are stored energy. Think about this from an evolutionary perspective. We were hunter-gatherers for most of our evolutionary existence. And after we developed agriculture roughly about 11,000 years ago, we were still moving around quite a bit. Well, as hunter-gatherers, we were moving 11 miles, 10 miles a day. Not many people move 10 or 11 miles a day. And we didn't have access to constant food supplies, so fat cells were a way of storing energy between access to food. Now we store too much energy, and now it's biodegrading, you could say. So let's take a look at what happens with fat cells. You get fat cells get surrounded by other fat cells. That means now you can't clear out the debris. So remember, cells are constantly dividing, and when they divide, you want this clearing out process. When fat cells circle other fat cells, there's a clogging up that happens. Your immune system goes crazy, and part of your immune system may include pro-inflammatory cytokines and anti-inflammatory cytokines. The pro-inflammatory cytokines head right towards this debris, and fat cells, the short answer here is the bottom line story is fat cells increase chronic inflammation. Chronic inflammation is a massive causal factor that is probably the hottest area of psychology and psychiatry over the last 20 years, because chronic inflammation causes depression, causes all these autoimmune disorders, causes dementia later on. So what are we talking about here? We're talking about the release and chronic circulation of these pro-inflammatory cytokines, including interleukin 6, interleukin 1, tumor necrosis factors. And what you see here is high levels of interleukin 6 and others are markers for who's going to develop diabetes type 2, that is going through the roof in terms of its overall prevalence in this country, in the United States especially. And so how does this relate to depression? Well, depression increases with inflammation. And with inflammation, you increase the dementia. With diabetes, you increase the propensity to develop dementia later on. So what some neurologists are now calling Alzheimer's is diabetes type 3. So you can be on the fast track to developing dementia or diabetes type 3 / Alzheimer's simply by these bad lifestyle practices that some people have started this process through not so good experiences early on, developing adverse lifestyle practices that result in these various types of behaviors. And what we know about these PICs or pro-inflammatory cytokines is they lower the level of various neurotransmitters in the brain that we have been paying attention to for the longest while, because we've been using all these pharmacological agents. Well, it's not like serotonin alone or dopamine alone is the cause of depression. But interestingly, inflammation can cause low levels of serotonin and dopamine and a number of other factors. And also, this large spectrum of studies have been focusing on what has been called sickness behavior. Sickness behavior is just feeling icky, feeling I feel like I'm getting the flu, or I don't know, maybe I have mononucleosis or Lyme disease or something. Well, chronic inflammation contributes to these icky feelings, and we now call that, since 1995, sickness behavior. And what if you've got sickness behavior? Well, what you're doing is you're behaving like you're sick. And if you behave like you're sick, what happens? Well, you don't get out, you don't move much, you're sitting around waiting to feel better. And what does that do? It promotes more depression. So what you have is this bad cycle that occurs. So you're eating a lot of foods that make you gain weight, feel icky anyway, simple carbohydrates and so on. Then you get chronic inflammation, you get the sickness behavior, you don't feel like moving much, and now you get even more depressed because you're not moving much. So this out of control cycle is a spectrum of various behaviors that is causing autoimmune disorders, causing depression, causing dementia. And you add in stress. And so now what you've got is the body feeling like it needs more glucose. Glucose is, you know, principal fuel that the body and the brain uses to run itself. So you got more glucose floating around. Now you can eventually develop insulin resistance. So now what you can see is the interaction between extra fat cells and stress giving you a fast track to this pre-diabetic syndrome. And what many people are now calling Alzheimer's is diabetes of the brain. So what we want to be taking a look at is how can we arrest and stop this unbundling of health. So we've got to consider mental health as physical health as mental health. The mind and the brain, the immune system, they're all interconnected. Just talking about the brain without talking about the immune system is incomplete. So we've got to talk about the effects of our overall experience of challenge. So one of the places I've been in the last year or two, I was in the Middle East, and we were training the aid workers of the Syrian refugees, and earlier training the Afghan government service workers in West Asia. And, you know, many people there obviously are experiencing a great degree of stress, and they don't have food available, especially in Syria, Jordan, and other places as readily, especially if you're in a refugee camp. And simple carbohydrates are there too often. So now you get the stress level, you get the bad diet, and then you're not moving much because you're just sitting around waiting to be adopted by some country. So I'm sure that some people have been hearing about gut bacteria and what's going on with gut bacteria. Well, just as a quick summary here, we have in our gut thousands of different types of bacteria, some good, some not so good. So you want to have the good gut bacteria that helps you synthesize from amino acids into neurotransmitters, the cornucopia of brain chemicals that we call neurotransmitters, neurohormones, and all that, in part are processed in the gut through gut bacteria, as long as you have a good selection of gut bacteria. So roughly about 90% of the gut bacteria are in these two broad categories. It's either the Firmicutes or the Bacteriates. You want more of the B than the F. You want more Bacteriates than Firmicutes. And the Firmicutes are the fat loving. They love simple carbohydrates. You eat a lot of simple carbohydrates, and I'm not just talking about sugar here. I'm talking about white rice and white flour. Let's say you like a beautiful sourdough bread, or you go to, you know, some Asian restaurant, you get a lot of white rice. Well, you know, both of those foods are partly digested for you. They turn into glucose too quickly, and they proliferate the amount of Firmicutes, not so good, causing inflammation, causing extra fat cells, causing all these acquired disease processes. So let's take a look at how you can increase the amount of gut bacteria, or I'm sorry, the amount of inflammation by a lot of different poor health behaviors that many people that have had ACEs do. You eat a lot of simple carbohydrates. Maybe you might even eat trans fatty acids, for example. You heard somewhere that blueberries are good, so you go eat blueberry muffins. Well, there might be six blueberries in your muffin, but just to get to those six blueberries, you're eating a huge amount of simple carbohydrates and trans fatty acids right there. Huge amount of calories as well. Then you add in saturated fats, you know, like hamburgers, for example. A Big Mac would be simple carbohydrates with saturated fat. And now you're adding in bad oils. You know, we've been so big on omega-6 at the expense of omega-3. Now you eat all these bad dietary foods, and now you just don't feel like moving much because you're so tired and everything. Now you're increasing the vulnerability to develop all these autoimmune disorders and including chronic pain syndromes and adding extra fat cells and increasing the amount of firmicutes. And with the simple carbohydrates with the saturated fat thrown in, you create this LPS factor, lipopolysaccharide, that is a result of eating saturated fat, and it gets attached to the firmicutes. And what happens there is you get more leaky gut syndrome. So the lining in your gut isn't that thick. And what we find is that people that have all these practices, millions and millions of people have leaky gut syndrome. And that means that they have more inflammation floating around the abdominal cavity, and they're feeling icky as a result of all these bad practices. Okay, so now let's talk about how some of these trajectories, health trajectories, develop over a period of time. So the developing brain goes something like this. You have many more neurons than your obstetrician or midwife, and it's a process of programmed cell death, apoptosis, and pruning that help us sculpt out an adaptive pattern to our principal caregivers. And what we find is these hungry brain networks, social brain networks, need stimulation. If they don't get stimulation, then we have impairment of the brain. Test case, of course, has been because they're in such high numbers and many people have adopted them, Romanian orphans, but we're not laying it all on Romanians. What we find is that throughout the Eastern Bloc countries and currently, even in Northern Korea, you have a lot of orphanage with people that are kids that are kept clean, kept fed. However, they have very social nourishment. If you're adopted later, you have impairments to your orbital frontal cortex, difficulty with cognition, less affect regulation, increased cortisol, and so on. And if you take a look at the so-called Romanian orphans, we're really talking about deprivation. What you find in the right of this slide is less prefrontal cortex development versus the left part of the slide, where you find more prefrontal cortex for so-called normal, whatever that normal is. And you find more impairment with child abuse, especially to the left prefrontal cortex, less left prefrontal activation, more right prefrontal activation, abnormal cell development, delays in myelination, and high levels of inflammation as measured by interleukin 6, tumor necrosis factor, C-reactive protein, and so on. How about looking at an abused brain? And what you find here too is the same sort of pattern. You have less development in the prefrontal cortex, more activity on the right prefrontal cortex, as I was just noting before, and the amygdala is active early in life, certainly more so than the yet-to-be-developed prefrontal cortex, and the amygdala does not like ambiguity. And so people that with less prefrontal activation tend to be more black and white in their thinking. are less able to see the full spectrum of experience. And so they're either on or off. Anxiety is on or off. And so what if your mother has depression early in your life? So you could say that's less activation early in your life, and your amygdala is running the show. Your prefrontal cortex can't negotiate ambiguity. So even with a still face paradigm, what we find is if your mother just sits here, not even having a frown on her face, and she's depressed, I don't mean to lay it on mothers, but your principal caregivers, let's say your father's the stay-at-home father and he's taking care of the kids and he's depressed. So the principal caregivers, depressed for the first 2 years of your life, now you're age seven, we measure your cortisol level. Your cortisol level is higher than other kids whose principal caregivers weren't depressed or zoned out on drugs or checking their iPhone all the time and just not engaging with you. We also find that they have overactive right prefrontal cortex, underactive left, lower levels of dopamine, serotonin. So this infrastructure of affect regulation involves a whole spectrum of neurochemistry and neural networks that not only relate to cortisol regulation, but maximizing endogenous opiates, endorphins, and so on. It involves positive neurotropic factors that help the brain adapt to and learn. So we're talking about learning impairment as a result of these early experiences as well. So there's a thermostat of attachment that has been looked at throughout all the attachment literature. And that thermostat has a lot to do with our capacity to develop neuroplasticity and learn from our experience. And briefly, I know probably a lot of you have been hearing in these seminars about neuroplasticity, but just a real quick nutshell. You know, you've got about 100 billion neurons in the brain. Each neuron's worth makes connections with about 10,000 other neurons. These cell structures, by necessity, need to be soft and pliable to make neuroplastic change. If your diet is full of simple carbohydrates, you cannot make these changes because of these advanced glycation end products that make your cell structures stiff and rigid. So diet impairs neuroplasticity. But if your diet gets better, you learn a lot, what you're doing is you're upregulating these synaptic connections, strengthening them through long-term potentiation. Glial cells, critically important to the health of your brain. In fact, the microglia, the really significant part of your immune system. So we can now look at the brain as it changes over time and look at how learning takes place just in 1/2 hour. If you are a little out of your comfort zone, and nevertheless, you're really trying to pay attention, you're trying to learn some complicated material, we could see actual spine growth take place in your brain. And Yerkes and Dodson knew about learning, but didn't know about the brain roughly about 100 years ago. And they found that if you're out of your comfort zone, better able to learn than if you are in your default mode network that I might touch on a little later, which is your tendency to fade off and not be where you are when you're there. You've got to be in a moderate degree of activation. Aristotle said everything in moderation, nothing in excess, or Buddha said, you know, the middle path. You could say you need to be moderately activated to learn. And so what if you're moderately activated and you are a bilingual person, you're going out and you're trying to learn Spanish, Russian, Mandarin, whatever, you can grow certain areas of your brain that are associated with these capacities, like angular gyrus for bilingual capacities, or Heschel's gyrus if you're a musician. And what we want is more connectivity. So the left side of the panel is more connectivity supporting a capacity skill-based. On the right side of the panel is more simplistic thinking, you could say. But you can also support anxiety by more connectivity, supporting the amygdala and the right prefrontal with fewer connections with the left prefrontal. So we're really talking about rewiring the brain, changing habits into good habits. And these habits, hopefully, can be changed over time by successive and continual effort. These are like grooves on a road. And to get a new habit to go, you've got to break out of the rut. And it's going to be a little uncomfortable in the beginning. But some people are really, really in a deep, deep rut. And so if they keep doing what they've been doing, they're just going to get worse and worse over a period of time. And so what we're wanting to do is help them where they start out. So we say to somebody, well, you know, you don't want to lift 250 pounds if you weigh barely 20 pounds. You start where the person is at. But you always add a little bit more than they think they're capable of dealing with. And then just like with bodybuilding in general, what you're doing is you're adding weights over a period of time. So one way to conceptualize and making it simple, neuroplasticity simple, is to use a mnemonic called FEED, feed your brain. First thing you need to do is turn on your prefrontal cortex. That's the F for this mnemonic. If you're not where you are when you're there, then what you're doing is your prefrontal cortex isn't on. You're not going to be able to learn what you're trying to learn. You need to have working memory alive. We psychologists have long measured working memory. Working memory is the gateway to long-term memory acquisition. Then you need to do what you don't feel like doing. That's the effort. And then after a while, after you do what you don't feel like doing, eventually you're going to feel like doing it. It isn't as hard as I once thought. Oh, this is becoming easier. So let's say you want to learn Russian. You want to go to St. Petersburg. And beautiful city, beautiful city. So first thing you need to do is turn on your prefrontal cortex. Then you need to do what you don't feel like doing, which is go to the Russian class and practice over and over again. After a while, it becomes effortless. You go to St. Petersburg, and you're able to ask people various questions, not just where the bathroom is. And then you come back to your respective cities, and you don't go to Russia for 7 years. Well, you're going to go back to baseline. It's like use it or lose it. So you need to stay determined to stay in practice. So that's the D. So let's shift gears and talk about one of the magic organic fertilizers that's available in your brain. And one of the ones of these neurotropic factors that's getting all the press is called brain-derived neurotropic factor, BDNF. And it does a lot of very wonderful things in addition to maximizing neuroplastic growth. It also acts on stem cells in the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex and the olfactory bulbs to grow new neurons. You know, when I was studying neuropsychology long ago, we were told that you'll have as many neurons as you ever have the day you're born. And it's all downhill from that. You want to speed up the process of cell death, drink a beer, get a head injury, have a fever, whatever. Well, actually, we were wrong. We can grow new neurons in these areas of the brain by maximizing the release of BDNF. So we want to do that. If you have ACEs early on, that doesn't mean you're done. You can maximize BDNF. And let's take a look at some of the factors and some of the relationships here. If you take a look at the slide that's sort of blue here, you can see new neurons in the hippocampus actually growing. This slide is actually from the area that I'm in now, in the San Diego area here at the Salk Institute, at Fred Gage's laboratory. Slide that says BDNF cell growth in 24 hours. This is one neuron in a petri dish with BDNF sprinkled in it. Look at the growth after 24 hours. This is magic organic fertilizer. So we want to maximize its production and release. Look at some of the things that affect it. Well, aging seems to slow it down. You can't stop aging, but you can slow down aging or you can speed up aging. Remember, ACEs speed up aging. Well, you can slow down the speed up, so to speak, if you practice healthy behaviors. Well, chronically high cortisol, like the Syrian refugees, Afghan folks that I was talking about before. One Afghan guy told me that, when I say goodbye to my children in the morning, I don't know if I'm going to see them in the evening. Can you imagine having that free-floating cortisol all day long? Well, slows down cell growth, slows down neurogenesis, shrinks the hippocampus. Look at the other factors. Marijuana. Well, I thought that was supposed to be a magic organic herb or something. Well, I'm all for the research on the cannabinoid receptors. Take out the THC, especially. And that would be a good thing because there's a lot of promising research on the pain reduction effects and all that. But I'm troubled by the THC factor here. More about that a little later if anybody has a question. How about obesity? This is far more prevalent. Obesity is a major factor with actually the shrinking of the hippocampus, the shrinking of the prefrontal cortex, as well as the block of neurogenesis. So let's now talk about the factors that increase neurogenesis. Aerobic exercise is at the top of the list. And again, from an evolutionary perspective, we're hunter-gatherers, move 10 miles a day, and now we do what many people call the new smoking, sitting. Sitting is the new smoking. And as a result, we're now impairing our brain. When I was in the Kaiser Permanente system, we did this big conference in Washington, and one of the speakers before me said that not exercising is worse than smoking diabesity. In other words, if you're obese, you've got diabetes, and you're smoking, that's better than not exercising. So it's an evolutionary imperative. Also, fasting is good for neurogenesis. So when I was hanging around with the yogis before I became a psychologist, as long as I was able to make it, and fasting was for a week, and it's kind of hard to do. You really got to know what you're doing and everything. But what we do know is fasting one day a week or even caloric restriction is good for neurogenesis. The food content that you consume. In other words, better essential fatty acids, good for neurogenesis. Weight loss is good for neurogenesis. So you can say to a client that you can grow new neurons in the area of your brain that gives you the capacity for memory. The first steps include maintaining a healthy diet, followed by aerobic exercise and cognitive exercise. Notice how I slipped that cognitive exercise in there. Well, the concept, of course, is that we want to build more connectivity. We want to build more network activity that can support what we call cognitive reserve. You want to be able to think in more complex ways. And if you can follow up your aerobic exercise by cognitive exercise, in other words, do some learning behavior, reading a complex subject after taking a brisk walk, then you are in better shape. I'm on the 30th floor of this Hilton here. And so I thought, oh, good, stairway. So I was able to go up my 30 floors. And boom, right afterwards, then, I was able to sit down. This was yesterday. I'm writing another book. And so, oh my God, my brain was so much more refreshed. Writing is learning in many ways. And so the combination of all these factors together, critically important, no matter who you are, you experience ACEs early on or whatever. Now, the social factor, absolutely critical for the integrity of your immune system. We know now that your immune system works better if you have better social relationships. People with bad social relationships are the ones that seem to falter. Like the people that I was mentioning before in domestic violence relationships, sure they have a relationship, but it's a disgusting relationship. So they have collapses of their immune system and so on. So the social factor critically important as part of the seeds factors. These seeds are these five healthy factors: social, exercise, education, diet, and sleep. We won't have time to talk about all of them, but in great depth. But with brain-based therapy, you could say, in terms of trying to orchestrate all of the factors to help a person get out of the deep rut of, let's say, depression, you need to orchestrate all the factors simultaneously. And what we find is that people who are depressed have been to multiple people throughout their lives. And maybe the therapist might be a CBT person or ACT person or whatever, psychodynamic or whatever. And they've spent all their time on this one particular area and don't include the wider spectrum. And oftentimes what we find is that when they jump from therapist to therapist, they say, oh, yes, I tried that and I tried this. Oh, that didn't work. My last therapist helped me with that. So what we need to do is help people do all these things simultaneously. You're the orchestrator of all these factors. So think of yourself as a symphony conductor, and you want the entire symphony to be part of this larger overall effort. So a mnemonic that you could use for helping a person remember what to do with regard to depression is team. You need a team of factors here. Thinking is important. Certainly all the CBT people have long promoted that, you know, held various cognitions can kind of get you off into a painting yourself into a corner. So we don't want to throw that out. We also know that effort is critically important. So let me give you a little bit of a perspective about this effort aspect. There's the effort-driven reward circuit in the brain. If you don't exercise that effort-driven reward circuit, you don't really get out of your rut. So remember that guy with the truck with the big wheels and all that? He's in a big deep hole. And so what he needs to do is get out of his car, dig out both sides. He needs to make an effort, and maybe we push start him. He has a stick shift, and we push him up to 30, 7 miles an hour or something like that. He pops his clutch, blah, 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 and he starts. Well, you can't get out of that hole with a car like mine. I have a electric car, Volt, press a button, boom. You can't levitate out of depression with a fancy thought. So effort is really critically important, has been part of the evidence-based practice for depression for the last 40 years. Acceptance is another factor that we really need to factor in. Many different therapeutic models have incorporated, like acceptance commitment therapy, the Buddhist models, and so on. And so many people that have had ACEs, for example, have to acknowledge that they have had some of these experiences. Many of my relatives, I'm an Armenian, and my relatives experienced the first genocide of the 20th century, and I heard horrible, horrible stories early on. To be able to move on, like the Bosnian refugees, Rwanda refugees, Syrian refugees, you have to kind of accept, doesn't make it good, but to be able to move ahead into a positive future. And so I needed an M, and I think being here now, so to speak, and mindfulness is a good way to conceptualize, activate your prefrontal cortex in a non-judgmental way, looking at, or you could say from a psychodynamic perspective with your observing ego or your wise mind, if you're a DBT aficionado or whatever, the same concept is inherent in all different theoretical perspectives. And I think it's a positive factor because you're looking at your current situation with some detachment and you're looking at it in a non-judgmental way. You don't have to be a Buddhist or Christian, Muslim or whatever. You could just incorporate this idea of watching yourself navigate through your world. So this idea of rebalancing your two hemispheres is very important. And I mentioned earlier that overactivation of the right prefrontal cortex is associated with anxiety and depression, underactive of the left with depression. So what we find is the same factors occur with anxiety. Overactive of the right prefrontal cortex, too much anxiety. So in other words, you're overwhelmed by too much. Oh my God, I can't see the forest for the trees. The left prefrontal cortex deals with detail and effort. And so what we find from a lot of research on long-time meditators, for example, if you're practicing compassion-based meditation, is there's a little bit more neuroplasticity in the left prefrontal cortex but more so than the right. So let me concretize this a little bit. When people are depressed and or anxious, you're either into a withdrawal or avoidant mode. If you withdraw when you're depressed, you get more depressed. If you avoid things that you're anxious about, you get more anxious. And what that does is overactivate your right prefrontal cortex. How do you get out of this? You do what you don't feel like doing. You do what is called approach behaviors. So in other words, what we're talking about is leaning towards life in a much more concerted way. So passive aggressive behavior actually cultivates more depression, more right frontal activity. And again, we're not saying the right prefrontal cortex is not a good thing. You get that wiped out in a stroke or whatever, you lose your sense of humor. So what's humor? Humor is metaphor, juxtaposition, seeing things from different angles. It's not making fun of somebody. That's called meanness. So it's getting engaged in life that is actually the aid through which, or the methodology to get out of these deep holes of depression and anxiety. So there's this nice Zen Buddhist saying that Zen is not like chopping wood, Zen is chopping wood. So the concept there is that engagement in life, instead of sitting back and passively watching everything go by, is the way to have a much more comfortable and satisfying, and I know there's a lot of happiness research out there, they call it happiness or satisfaction in life, because you are engaged in life. Okay. Christy, are there any questions? I know there's one thing I did want to mention, the five healthy factors, but I'll do that maybe if there are any questions to respond to.
We've absolutely got some questions, but if you'd like to go into those factors, you might already be answering some questions by doing so.
Sure, why don't I go ahead? So the five healthy factors, you know how I was trying to put things in mnemonics so that people can remember them. I mean, let's face it, we as healthcare professionals have a tendency to forget things a lot. And now think about it, if you got a lot of ACEs, you got anxiety, you got depression, you got all these healthcare problems like obesity and diabetes and all that, it's hard to remember things. So the five healthy factors that I've been talking about that the literature strongly supports for longevity, helping the brain stay more active are the SEEDS factors. So what are they? S for social factor. So I've been talking about some of these only briefly. The first E, exercise, aerobic exercise. The second E, education. So we know now that the more learning you do later on in life, the more connectivity you have, the more you can lose later on in life without looking like you lost much. So we could say that's cognitive reserve. The D in SEEDS is diet. And the last S is sleep. There's no one thing called sleep. And we know now that a lot of people are trying to achieve good sleep by doing all sorts of confounding things, like taking medications. And what we find is the sleep architecture gets disrupted. So we really want to have good slow-wave sleep. That's where your immune system gets bolstered. Many people are taking these over-the-counter medications, like these Benadryl-infused medications. So we know from recent research that suggests that you're taking Benadryl on a regular basis. Actually, you're upping the increase vulnerability for dementia later on. We also know that a lot of people are on these benzodiazepines for sleep. Now, it might make some people angry, but I call them the garbage of the healthcare system. They decrease the level of slow-wave sleep. By the way, alcohol decreases slow-wave sleep, too. Marijuana as well. And so we don't want to decrease slow wave sleep. We want to have good sleep architecture. Okay, sorry for that little tangent, but the idea is seeds. Planting seeds over your lifetime can keep you healthier, happier, and can help you with your overall longevity.
Thank you for that. I'm tracking the mnemonics here, and I think I'm going to feed myself the seeds of the team.
Keep your team going with the seeds, and they're all planting together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's actually better. Okay.
Agriculture.
I wanted to take you back to inflammation and just like go right back to the foundation of all of this. Can you unpack what inflammation is and how it relates to our immune system and overall health?
So think in terms of getting a cut on your finger. Inflammation is a very important part of the healing process. So you gotta, like, I'll use myself as an example. 3 weeks ago, I got bit by a pit bull. And sure enough, the big gash on my hand that I had to go to the emergency room, get stitched up and all that kind of stuff, just got all inflamed. And the inflammation actually helped seal off the area to help it heal to some degree. That's a good inflammatory process. So inflammation is critical for the immune system, good for healing and all that. My inflammation went down relatively quickly. However, what if I have inflammatory factors that are chronic? If I eat a lot of simple carbohydrates, have a lot of fat cells and all that are always leaching out these pro-inflammatory cytokines, then I got chronic low-grade inflammation. I don't need the inflammation. I don't have a cut on my hand here. I don't need chronic inflammation. I would imagine all the listeners know that when you are ill, your immune system is busy trying to deal with the illness, or you've got some kind of an infection. You know, we can measure your temperature rate. We know now there's, your body's trying to fight something off. And your immune system is activated, and that means inflammation is, your pro-inflammatory cytokines are all over the place and all that. We want it to work well to go help you through the healing process, and that's a good thing. We don't want it to be constant and low grade over a long period of time, because now what you have is the down regulation of this cornucopia of neurotransmitters. You get cell structures that don't get their nutrients because they're sealed off from other cells and all that. So we could say that inflammation is a good thing when you need it. You don't want it when you don't need it. And you don't want it all the time because you don't need it all the time. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. You know, I think because a lot of terms get tossed around and we don't always know what we're speaking about, you know, so it's good to have that clarified for us. I'd also like to talk a little bit about the stages of sleep or sleep architecture that you mentioned just toward the end of your presentation and how important it was to go through all of them. What are those cycles that seem to be impaired by the use of drugs, alcohol, prescriptions?
Sure. So think, it was almost 100 years ago. Actually, it was about 80 years ago that Kleitman and Sitsinski, I forget the other guy's name, but they measured through the early development of the EEG that we go through these sleep cycles as measured by brain waves. And so the sleep cycles go something like this. You have four stages of sleep. Actually, now three and four are collapsed into the same. So we used to say four stages, but now we say three. So when you're dropping off into sleep, you still have a sleep pattern that has more active waves that look not quite like what we had, more sort of alpha, and you're drifting in and out and all that, and more like what we're hopefully using now, but every once in a while you're fading off, and then you drop down. You drop down and the waves start getting slower. And those slower waves are representative of less complex thought. So if you get woken from a deep sleep, most probably you're not going to have, I'm not saying not going to have, but most probably you're not going to have any vivid dreams. The vivid dreams actually occur during what we call rapid eye movement sleep. And if you look at the brain waves associated with rapid eye movement sleep and compare them to the brain waves that we have right now, it almost looks about the same. Remember, when you're going through these dreams and everything, you know, people might be chasing you, or you might you know, show up at an English class that you didn't know until the end of the semester that you were enrolled to, and you're going to flunk because you weren't, you know, whatever. Somebody's, you know, after you or whatever. That's a whole lot different. So these are vivid dreams, and your brain's super active. And the REM sleep is more packed towards the end of your sleep cycle. The slow wave sleep, delta wave sleep, is more packed towards your earlier part of your sleep cycle. So let me use an example of what people experience in my neighborhood. I live in the wine country in Northern California. I live in West Sonoma County. And people come to me and they say such things as, you know, I wake up in the middle of the night, around 2 o'clock, and I can't seem to get back to sleep until about 4. What the heck's the problem? And I often say, or ask rather, boy, are you drinking any wine at night? And they say, yeah, I'm drinking a glass or two of wine at night. What's your problem? And I say, well, you know, what actually happens there is that you're blockading the glutamate receptors and giving yourself a counterfeit GABA. So the principal two neurotransmitters in the brain are GABA and glutamate. And GABA is the inhibiting neurotransmitter, glutamate is the activating neurotransmitter in the brain. So when you drink a wine at 5 o'clock at night, 8 o'clock, or whatever, this is really cool. This is, well, the 4 hours later, the glutamate blockade breaks off, and the GABA is less available to you because your brain thought it had some. And so what happens there is, that was a long-winded way to get back to slow-wave sleep. What happens there is the drop in into slow-wave sleep isn't gonna happen as readily because now you get agitated, too much glutamate. And as a result of that, you don't achieve that deep level. You've got counterfeit GABA in there. Or now you're throwing you're blasting yourself with these other chemicals that activate the GABA receptors in a counterfeit sort of way, like the benzos and other factors. So you don't get down there. And so if you take a look at a medicated brain versus a clean brain in sleep, there's a dramatic difference between the two of them. I probably should have had that in my slide circuit, but this was only an hour presentation. So you end up with shallow sleep as a result. And what happens there? You wake up feeling unrested. You're more depressed. Your immune system doesn't get bolstered. And you are kind of short-fused. You know, you're irritable. And maybe you feel like you need to take a nap or something. So as a consequence, also your telomeres shrink. So we also know there's chromosomal damage with bad sleep architecture and a number of other factors. I think I'm rambling on too much. Sorry about that.
Well, no, this is great information because for anyone headed to happy hour, this is something to consider. Now, what about the information about a glass of wine with dinner being beneficial to our health?
Well, think in terms of all the discussion that we've had about the phytochemical called resveratrol. And resveratrol was this so-called is this antioxidant that was supposedly found in the skin of the red grape. And it is found in the skin of the red grape, but it's also found in the skin of many high pigment fruits. So you can eat red grapes and the skin of the red grape and get your lower resveratrol. Now, there was this panacea that drinking red wine at night, oh, this is wonderful. But as it turns out, as I was mentioning at the conference actually a few hours ago, you get better quality resveratrol with organic Pinot grapes than some of the other grapes. It turns out the organic is much better because, believe me, living in the wine country and I'm driving around all these vineyards all the time and everything else, those of you that aren't drinking organic wine are drinking wine that was made out of grapes that were sprayed. And there were a lot of different chemicals sprayed all over the place there. So you're drinking a lot of chemicals that might interrupt the metabolism of the phytonutrient, the resveratrol and all that. So there's that factor. The factor of there's resveratrol with the phytonutrient, the antioxidant and all that. It turns out that you've got to eat a lot of that resveratrol to even get a benefit. And then you're going to shrink your hippocampus anyway, because it turns out too that drinking a lot actually shrinks your hippocampus. Can I rattle on about the effect of a wine on the hippocampus? Do I have time?
Yes. Yes. Okay.
So there was an interesting study in Germany that wanted to measure different sizes of the hippocampus for different populations. So the largest hippocampus was for people that didn't drink alcohol at all. The second largest was among people that drank beer, and there were alcoholics that drank beer. The third largest was for the spirit drinkers. I would think it would be they would have the smallest. But you know who had the smallest hippocampus? The wine drinkers. That was shocking. Shocking. Now, let me say I felt compelled to talk about this red wine grape factor and all that. But let me also say a little bit of alcohol every once in a while, actually, according to a lot of research, isn't a bad thing. Drinking a glass of wine once a week or two times a week and all has been correlated with health and all that. It's how much and how often. And so if you drink every night, you're going to get some sleep deprivation. You're going to get some mood problems. And those of us like myself, I used to do neuropsychological testing and all that. What we used to say is don't test a wet brain. For how long after your last drink? For 3 months after your last drink. And so you're going to get some artifacts of disrupted neurochemicals and dampened cognition and all that. Now, do I drink wine? Heck yes, I love wine. And do I drink it all the time? Just like birthday cake, I don't eat birthday cake all the time. It's a treat. I'm at a party, you know, they're going to have some big gathering here at this conference, and, you know, I'll have a half a glass of wine and all, or maybe a full glass of wine or whatever. But I don't do it every night, just like I don't eat birthday cake every night. I love these craft beers, too. They're great. And if you drink once or twice a week or something like that, like small amounts, actually it has been correlated with health. In some way. I'm not promoting it, but it's, again, back to Aristotle or the middle path, you know, everything moderation or the middle path, so to speak. You know, you do something on a regular basis, there are going to be some health outcomes. And the whole panacea about drinking on a regular basis because somebody told you that red wine was great for you, it didn't seem to work out in the literature as well.
Okay. Mac has a question. He asks, if premature newborns are predisposed to insecurity and hypervigilance, would you suggest that they're also more prone to poor lifestyle practices, drug dependency, and trouble maintaining meaningful relationships? And if so, do you have suggestions for actions that parents might take to hinder these behaviors?
Okay, so let's start with preemies to begin with. So I don't know if your listeners know about, I think her name is Tiffany Field at University of Miami, and she had preemie, and she's actually an expert on touch and the effect of touch. And partly related to her research and others, what we find is that if you go into the nursery, let's say you have a preemie, if you go into the nursery and sit with your baby, stroking the baby's hand and feet, those babies thrive better and get out of the hospital sooner and don't have as many adverse outcomes as others. So now there are hundreds, I don't know the actual number, but many volunteers that actually go to nurseries nowadays and go sit with the preemies and stroke their feet and give them tactile, you know, warm cuddling, you know, can't lift them up and all that. It will sound later. There's better health outcome with more tactile stimulation and better affect regulation. So now let's move towards, okay, so now you have a preemie that's now a child and adolescent and all that. I strongly feel, of course, you know, I'm a psychologist and, you know, I'm in this profession in general, that, okay, you start out bad. I don't mean bad, but I mean, start out with some limitations. Start out, maybe you were preemie and that doesn't mean you're going to be fumbling through the rest of your life, or you start out with ACEs. Let me give you a great example of somebody that started out with ACEs. He certainly wasn't a preemie, but Ludwig von Beethoven, father beat him up. He was an alcoholic. He was a domestic violence perpetrator. Beethoven went to the church and played Bach fugues, constantly. That was his escape, but it was also his ability to transcend and create something greater than his angst. He then won a scholarship to go study in Vienna with Papa Haydn. And Papa Haydn was this wonderful guy that was, you know, everybody liked, and he was a promoter of other people younger than him, like Mozart, who he took under his arm and all that. He studied with Papa Haydn, and Beethoven was just cranky, you know, he was still angry and all that. He got this letter to go back to Bonn because your mom just died and your drunk dad is now in charge of your two brothers who aren't old enough to go out and fly on their own. Oh, I got to go back to Bonn and raise them. So what he did was he went back to Bonn and kicked his father out of town. He petitioned the magistrate of Bonn, get this guy out of town, he's a derelict, and he told his two brothers, don't ever say Johann again, his name is history. You don't want to remember it at all. He raised his two brothers, okay, you guys ready? You can go out and get a job, okay? I got to go back to Vienna to become a composer. Okay, so he went back to Vienna, poor guy. By 1797, he started going deaf. By 1803, he knew it was incurable. He wrote a suicide note to his brothers. Nobody knows I'm going deaf. They're not going to buy my music. Instead of killing himself, he set aside the suicide note and he wrote the Third Symphony that transcended classical music for all time. The Third Symphony broke us out of the classical period into a totally different period of music and transcended everything. So you start out bad, let's say with ACEs, or you start out compromised because you're a preemie, let's say, and can you transcend? Can you move ahead? Let's say you're like my relatives who experienced this terrible genocide, and my grandfather saw his first wife and child murdered in front of him by a Turk. I'm not saying anything bad about Turks. This is a long time ago. And he suffered this guilt throughout his entire life. Other relatives lying under dead bodies until the, you know, Turks passed and all that. Just disgusting stuff. These people made something. These are a lot of ACEs, right? Viktor Frankl, great example. He's probably one of the best guys in our field ever. What a wonderful human being. He was in Auschwitz. He saw tremendous tragedy. And then he came up with this incredibly powerful and positive psychology that was the precursor of many other types of concepts that these new, I call them franchises, these other letter-based therapies that incorporated but never gave him credit for some of the ideas that he came across. So can you transcend? Can you move ahead and go beyond? You're a preemie, member of ACEs, genocide later on or whatever. Heck yes, that's why we are in the healthcare field. However, we've got to understand some of these disease processes and consider them as part of our picture here. It's not all just about talking about your feelings. Those are absolutely critical. But it's also about paying attention to the mind, the brain, and the immune system. Meaning you've got to have some seeds factors here. And if you don't have these seeds factors, you're not going to be able to generate positive feelings and positive emotions and everything else. You're going to set yourself up to age quicker. Even if you have no ACEs, even if you were never a preemie, you're going to end up dying sooner. So what we want to do is promote healthy behaviors constantly throughout our lives, planting and cultivating these seeds throughout our life.
I'd like to end. We have time for one more question. I want to end just kind of touching more on that social aspect of the seeds. This question comes from Jerry. I find making friends harder to do as I age. What are your suggestions for cultivating supportive community as social medicine in an environment where we're so consumed by our gadgets? I wonder whether doing what I don't want to do in this sense of going out to meet new people, I wonder if that would create more social anxiety than is beneficial.
That is such a timely question. Before I get into some aspects of it, I want to pay homage to some of the research and some of the popular books by Sherry Turkle, who's an MIT psychologist who has written about the effects of social media and isolation and the illusion of connectivity that we have. Now, with regard to the heart of his question, which relates to as we age, it's harder to make connections with other people. And you take a look at, you know, when we were young in high school and college and graduate school or whatever, you know, you're around other people and, you know, it's easy to make friends and, you know, meeting this person, that person and everything. And we get off into our little lives out here. And also, you have more commonalities early in life than in later in life. We kind of get off in our own little, you know, interest areas. Ah, so that might be the way back. So what I've often, and many people that I've worked with have promoted, is later in life, it's harder to just go meet someone. You don't go to a supermarket and go, hello, I keep seeing you at the supermarket. Oh, this is fantastic. How are you? Sometimes they get a little anxious if they were to try to strike up a conversation. And the other person might go, he's coming on to me. What's going on here? So we need some structure. And in fact, early in our life, we did have this structure. We called it school or other social activities. So with activities later in life, let's face it, a lot of people that have a little bit of social anxiety can't go just meet people to be in a meeting people situation, but rather they get involved in common lifestyle hobby type groups. Let's say, for example, you're interested in hiking. Well, then join the Sierra Club, and everybody's out there and they're hiking. And incidentally, you can have conversations with people that have a common interest, but you don't necessarily have to do that. Or during a political campaign, you can be a volunteer and everybody's working on the campaign together, or it's an initiative or whatever. There are so many different volunteer groups that people can be involved in. And the fact of the matter is, this is really strongly related to the brain-based dynamics. When you are giving and you're doing something like going to a soup kitchen on Thanksgiving and scooping out, you know, food for the homeless or whatever, you're activating the same neural circuits for compassion for other people as well as for yourself. And those neural circuits relate to the anterior cingulate, the insula, and some other areas. So now you're with other people that are doing compassionate-based behaviors that make you feel like you got self-love. And also the people that you're doing it with, it's an easier way to connect with them because you're both feeling this connectedness with other people and yourself while you're both doing it. So it's easier to connect with other people when you're doing social enhancement for people that are disadvantaged or, you know, saving the environment or whatever. But especially if it's social based, if you're helping people that are needy, then you really got a multiple levels of structured behavior that rhyme with these connectedness brain circuits. So the short answer is structured behaviors in socially compassionate environments are like greasing the wheels for friendships and spin-offs outside of that structured environment.
Dr. John Arden, thank you so very much for all of this insight and tools that we can use to help us make more connections, more healthy connections.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure to be here today. And thanks to all of you for listening today. I very much appreciate it.
This concludes the 20th and final live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. Once again, our gratitude goes out to Dr. John Arden for this outstanding presentation. The recording of this session will remain accessible for free for 24 hours. You also have the opportunity to purchase the series, which is the entire downloadable library of 30 hours of teachings, practices, unlimited access to each recording, transcripts, and bonus gifts from our presenters. Over the last week and a half, we've been given lots of detailed neuroscientific information, much of which might warrant repeat listening to digest all of the implications of this material. And to embody it all, that's another story entirely. If this material resonates with you, I invite you to click the button on this page. As you may have noticed, I've bookended each of these sessions by telling you what an honor and pleasure it is to introduce you to these exceptional teachers, because it really has been. In fact, it's been a tremendous experience, not only to co-host this Neuroscience Training Summit with Tammy Simon, but to have connected with and learned something life-changing from each of these presenters, and from some of the most deeply heartfelt feedback that you, our viewers, have submitted as well. Now, if that's not an honor, I don't know what is. For Sounds True, I'm Christy Peoples. Thank you so very much to all of our presenters once again for distilling such leading-edge information, and to each of you, our viewers, for making it an exceptional experience. SoundsTrue.com, many voices, one journey.